it's the notice. I don't know, Comrade Shiva, whether you think what your views are. My own view is that it's fine if they do it, but I don't think we can join them. That's the one thing.
Yes? I think that on Monday, because everyone came to the house, I have to be in the room. So it's a very good answer. Yeah.
Save the Children are convening, it's an NGO I gather, convening a workshop from yesterday till tomorrow. This I got this morning on the submission of State Party and alternative reports to the UN Committee as well as the African Committee on the Rights and Welfare of the Child. And they would like us to attend. It's taking place. Same way in Pretoria. Yeah, that's it. And then, oh yes, it is in Pretoria. Yeah. And then, Women's Legal Center, I'm not sure what they want from us. They've sent me and my counterpart in the NCOP this letter, National Policy Framework on Sexual Offences. They apparently sent me an email which I haven't responded to. They held a working group meeting on 28th February and formulated recommendations. They want public participation. After careful review, the campaigners of the view that the most recent version of the national policy framework provided to us by the Department of Justice does not adequately address this purpose. So it looks like they want to engage with the department on the national policy. We were supposed to get that national policy, Christine. Have we received it? How come they've got it? Because they're speaking about the national policy and it's inadequate. So can you just check with... okay. I think that's it. If there's any questions? No. Yes.
I do think it's worth writing back to those people and saying we would love to participate in these occasions, but you need to understand that we need a bit of notice, like not yesterday and a week's notice. Thank you.
It's going to be just about impossible to fit anything else in. The only reason we fitted you lot in, Mr. Bassett, is because you said you're ready. And so we said, okay, before the budget process starts, let's have you here and then see what you've got to say. But from tomorrow and the whole of next week, that's it. Yeah. But if you come back with us with something on harassment, we'll try and fit you in. You're not an NGO. All right.
Wondering about trafficking. We're meeting, just to give you feedback, our working document is proceeding well and we're having a meeting with the NPA on Friday. We were hoping to have a meeting with them earlier, but they've indicated that they're ready to meet with us on Friday. So I think we're also nearly ready with trafficking.
I'm not sure if you're present in the meeting, but the committee has agreed that priority number one will be state liability bill. Yeah. Because of the Constitutional Court deadline, all right? So, I mean, we can't just ignore that. And then after that, or in line with that, is the budget process. Next in line would be trafficking. Am I correct, Steve? And then the rest, as and when we can deal with it. Right. So that's how the committee is looking at the priorities, okay? So your meeting on Friday is most welcome. We're glad to hear it. Dr. Ambrosini.
No, I don't want to suggest any change, but just as a thought. I mean, this bill before us is relatively, it's much simpler than all the others. Can we not just get through and finalize it so that we don't have all these bills on our desk?
No, I think when we looked at our priorities last week, the intention is not to say that if a bill isn't ready for adoption, that we won't adopt it, because it's not number one. If the bill is ready for our adoption, we'll adopt it. And as you say, Dr. Ambrosini, then get it off our desk or table. So, that will be our approach. Okay. Mr. Bassett, welcome to you and your team. Honorable members will have received your documents via email, so we're ready for you to take us through.
Thank you, Chair. I have all my documents. Yes, Chair, and my colleagues will help me. I think let me just go through the documents that were circulated. There was a document, responses to remarks and questions by the Portfolio Committee. There we tried to, some of the questions that were raised and observations and comments that were made, we tried to address those. And we can elaborate on some of them as well. So there's that document, and then there's a working document that has been adapted as well in line with discussions to date. And then there is the Domestic Violence Act, I think, that was circulated. The comments from some of the service providers, MTN, ISPA, that's the Internet Service Providers Association, from Telkom, on the proposed new provisions relating to cyber stalking. We haven't received comments from some of the service providers. Mr. Roberts, if you can help me, I think Vodacom haven't responded in writing, but they have responded verbally, and I think there might be one or two near, and Cell C that haven't responded. We've also put some regulations on the domestic violence legislation in here as examples that we might want to have a look at. I think those are the most important documents. I'm not going to go through all of them. And then there is a document that was also submitted by email. It's an extract from the Law Reform Commission's report on or discussion paper on sexual offences. Sexual offences, trying to address or giving some background, I think, to Dr. Ambrosini's concerns regarding the indirect cross-examination of complainants. It gives some sort of rationale to the importance of having a provision of that nature. So those are the documents that are circulated. Chair, if you will allow me, in the Star yesterday I saw an interesting little article, and if I can read it to you, it relates to cyber stalking. I don't know whether any of you saw it. It's disappeared. Yes. May I just read it quickly? The heading is "Beware the Woman Scorned, Facebook Targets Them." This is from London. Women are finding it increasingly difficult to move on once a relationship has ended because Facebook invites them to stalk their former lovers via the internet. Experts have likened the habit of following boyfriends on the web to the lure of online gambling. According to the first British study into cyber stalking, about 35% of victims are now men, with virtually all their cases perpetrated by women. Offline, just 8% of harassment victims are male, with female stalkers a rarity. Dr. Short, a psychologist at the University of Bedfordshire in England, has had hundreds of responses to an online survey as part of a research with the Network for Surviving Stalking. The findings reveal that women leave unwanted messages for their ex-partners on their Facebook pages, send inappropriate emails, and set up fake accounts to lure them into communicating with them. Women who would not be able to overpower men physically can have a go at them online, she says. So just I thought it was interesting that cyberstalking is something very real. This, of course, is more in the domestic, in our domestic violence legislation, where there's a domestic relationship. But I thought I would just convey that to the committee as a matter of interest. Chair, I'm not too sure how you want us to go through the poll. Are we going to, we'd like guidance how we should deal with it. Do we start at the beginning and go through the clauses as adapted, and then talk to the response document as and when we get to those particular points?
I'll do that, but you know, you can just point out that there was no questions on a particular clause, and therefore you can skip it and move on to the next one. So, alright.
Ask Mr. Norbert to take us through that.
Honest, I would propose that we start with the response to the remarks and move through that. In response to this, certain amendments were affected to the bill. I will, after this, go back to the bill and indicate further clauses that were added to the bill. If I may start. The first issue that was raised when we last deliberated the bill was the cost issue relating to the compliance of section or clause 3A of the bill. Clause 3A relates to obligation placed on electronic communications service providers to provide certain information to a court if a person has been stalked. And I believe Mr. Swart and Dr. Abrasini raised the question regarding the cost aspect relating to what it may cost service providers to provide this information. I've already indicated that we're actually using the current RICA database that has been established in terms of the RICA legislation, where this information is stored. And in terms of the RICA legislation, after a consultation with the service providers, a costing has been done and certain sub-owner legislation was made in terms of which the electronic communication service providers is compensated for rendering this service to the law enforcement agencies. I want to refer the honourable members to Annexure A, that is the subordinate legislation that was made to give effect to the RICA obligations. And as you can see that on inter alia page 15 of the Government Gazette, we prescribe certain fees that must be paid for the provision of archived communication related information. Although I believe during the discussions I used the terminology archived communication related information, what will also be relevant to stalking legislation will be real-time communication related information. But it's basically the same. It relates to call-related information to a call that can identify certain aspects of that call. If the honourable members can look on page 14, inter alia of the lecture, provision is also made for this real-time communication information that must be provided, and the fees are substantially less. I think it amounts to around about 46 around 30. The information that is addressed here relates to fixed line operators as well as mobile cellular operators, and they are discussed in the annexure under the appropriate heading. So in general, it's our submission that there's not going to be any cost aspect relating to the implementation of clause 3A. And in any event, that the regulations give a fair indication of what it will cost the state if this information is provided to a court.
honourable members, are there Dr. Andrusini?
May I, with your indulgence, just qualify where I come from? I had an exchange with someone just a second ago, and she said, why are you concerned about the protecting the perpetrator? And see, a great deal in this type of bills is how do you do justice legislation? How do you write justice legislation? I believe that justice legislation should be written with the perpetrator in mind, with the communist, with the anarchist, with the terrorist, whoever is the bad guy, and having in mind that each and every of them could be us. I mean, it's alienating humanity, whoever they are, in a different compartment, is the root of a great deal of evil. I mean, we are writing legislation for citizens, and if they do something wrong, they need to be punished, but they are citizens and those whom we represent nonetheless. So I do have a concern about this. And the first concern is if we look at the Protection of Personal Information Bill that we are working on, there the principle that we are asserting in terms of privacy is that no one should keep your information. Now, whom you call, who you send messages to, is critical information which the other bill requires to be deleted as soon as possible and not to be made available from anyone. So I would be very concerned about any provision that does not that could be read by the service provider as entitling it to maintain records or whom you call for how long, where and when. The second concern that I have, and I'm not going to change my viewpoint because Mr. Bassett tells me that men are the vulnerable class of mine was a matter of principle. So I will expose myself to the thing. But the truth of the matter, Mr. Chairman, in each and every of these programs, whether it's your Outlook Express, your Facebook, there is always a possibility of barring people. So at a certain point, we don't want to live in a society in which nobody can express feelings. Why did you not smile at me? That's harassment. Why are you speaking to me in that tone of voice? I mean, we need to react to that which is socially unacceptable. And I'm always concerned about raising those thresholds above what society requires. I've seen what happened in America. Everyone is extremely sensitive about doing anything wrong, and at the end the population grows meek. I really think that it would be important to preserve the anonymity, and I haven't been able to now read 3A carefully and I see what has been written, that there is an opportunity to for the person whose anonymity is about to be revealed to be notified, but I don't see, unless I read it incorrectly, that there is an opportunity for that person to timely object to his anonymity being revealed. And here we are in a situation where we need to look at the conflict of interest, the conflict of rights. On the one side there is the right to privacy, on the other one there is the potential right to be free from harassment in a context where the harassment is perhaps at the least painful or the least concerning. And I don't buy into the argument, oh, it all starts like that and then ends up in murder and rape. No, it doesn't. I mean, it's if every time we express the disappointment, we end up for murder and rape. And I don't think it's a good way of legislating.
Well, the response to it will be that the whole concept of harassment is based on the principle that it should be reasonable. if there is certain reasonable conduct and you act within that reasonable conduct, obviously it will not amount to harassment. But it will happen and does happen that some acts exceed the bound of reasonability and this causes harm to the complainant. And our submission is that in that instances the complainant must be protected. Well, I cannot understand why a person's identity or particulars need to be concealed if he actually engaged in certain harmful conduct to society. I think the bony morals of society will require that the person's particulars be revealed so appropriate steps can be taken against him to inter alia prohibit him from further harming society. Regarding the Protection of Personal Information Act, the information that we are dealing with here, as is mentioned, is stored in terms of the RICA legislation. There's a requirement in terms of law. And if one looks at the current proposed clause 15.3 of the Protection of Personal Information Bill that is being considered by this committee, it's a make provision, therefore, that certain information provided to comply with the obligations imposed by law or for conduct of proceedings in front of the court is actually exempted from the provisions of the Protection of Personal Information Bill.
Chair, just generally an observation. The Law Commission, as we know, investigated this and came up with proposals in the bill that was eventually tabled in Parliament, and there was consensus and legal minds that were in the Law Commission found it necessary that we do need to have protection like this, where members of society have to be protected. We've given some examples in this response document of some of the serious instances and cases what can happen with stalking and cyber stalking more particularly, and it is a concern. The bill that was introduced into Parliament didn't deal with cyber stalking specifically. There was an argument, and I think maybe Ms. Clark can help me here, that the bill has introduced, you could have dealt with stalking, cyber stalking, but the difficulty was that to try and identify the stalker, and the general public, when they commented on the bill, said that there was an outcry to say there's a gap in this legislation and something needs to be done to deal with stalking in a more concrete manner and more effective manner, and that's what we are doing now. There are various rights, as Dr. Amrasini has said. Stalking relates to privacy, it relates to dignity, it relates to security of the person, and I think as the state, section 7.2 of the Constitution says, the state must respect, protect, promote and fulfill the rights and the Bill of Rights. So I think it's in that context that we're coming up with these proposals. Thank you very much.
Chair, I think the revised provision that have put in a few extra safeguards regarding identity, and I think we need to look at those to protect people. But really, I mean, once the court has satisfied itself, and only after they've done that, will they be able to even issue an interim order. I mean, then the guy loses his, or woman, and that's the case, loses their right to anonymity. I mean, you can't harass them unless they say, I need to retain my anonymity. Then you don't harass people.
I think the role Ms. Dr. Ambrosini is trying to play in this process, and I hope I'm not going to misrepresent you, but if I do, please intervene, is that he's trying as far as possible to also protect the rights of the other party, albeit the perpetrator, or should we say the alleged perpetrator. So let's understand his role. He's not saying that he's opposed to the bill. I'd be very surprised if he was. But Dr. Andresini, you do realize that all your call related information, every single bit of it, even where you made the call or took the call, is stored somewhere by the service providers. That is determined by law. It's called RICA. Okay? It's the kind of law that you find all over the world. Well, let's say in most democratic countries. This Justice Portfolio Committee is the one, Mr. Sibanyoni, that helped consider that act and put it on the statute book. It's worked well thus far. And so we satisfied that there are enough checks and balances in that act to ensure that your information is not just made public willy-nilly, given by the courts. So I just thought I'd make that point. But let me hear you, Dr. Emerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I shall not contradict you in any way. Two items. The interest that we are protecting here is that of being free from mental and psychological detriment. That's the definition of harm. And this issue I will raise later. I, for one, am not capable of identifying what the difference is between mental and psychological. Because it cannot be a headache, because that's physical. But this is what we're dealing with. Mental and psychological detriment. And that protection of the interest is the one that needs to be assessed against the interest of privacy. And my concern is that even under the revised text, if I understand it correctly, it is not the harasser whose identity is going to be revealed, by the alleged harasser. It's an ex-party, person doesn't have the opportunity of objecting, it's on the basis of evidence. Anyone who is involved in the practice of law knows how uncertain ex-party procedures are. Under the best of circumstances, even when things are not emotionally charged, when you're dealing with facts, courts constantly get it wrong because they depart from the fundamental principle of audio alteram partem. They don't listen to the other side. Here we are dealing with something which exists exclusively in the mind of a person, the mental and psychological detriment. There are no bruises, there is no nothing. And what is it? Is it one harass, one SMS, two SMS, three SMS? In this environment, in this context, and we know that from marriage litigation, marriage practices, which are very emotionally charged. People express emotions, and very often restraint orders are utilized within the practice of emotions going to court, perhaps where they should not belong. So I would just have a word of caution. So let's try to be. At this juncture in a South African context, if we are to err, let's err on the side of doing less rather than more. We can always come back. Once freedoms are taken away, as in the case of RICA, they will never come back. And German says democracy, but it's the light of democracy is growing pale by the day. Paler.
Thing is, in connection with things like divorce cases, you're going to know who the person is. So I don't really think that those are going to be the majority of cases where this is an issue. That it's obviously emotional, but you'll know who's doing it. And the question is then, if you're going to not provide for this, then how are you going to find out the identity of the person who's harassing? Are you going to allow them to carry on harassing the person anonymously forever? What other options are there? I can't think of it.
Mr. Chairman, it's wonderful having the debate. I really thank you for this. But it is on the label of everything else. That's what I'm afraid I'm the camel nose. If I send you flowers every day and you feel harassed because of that, there is no legislation which compels the florist to have a record of all the flower shipments it carries. So one needs to go through the usual things of asking the police, conducting an investigation, etc. So you find out, etc. We are now dealing with the internet, with service providers, keeping records for this reason. It's like RICA, keeping records for terrorists, and we're all keeping records for terrorists. Great deal of things are done, bad things are done for the right reasons. And it would be the same as any other form of harassment. The identity of the harassers will need to be identified.
Question you were asked, Dr. Ambrosini, is how? And I seem to recall that you saying at one point, well, the onus then is on the person, the complainant. But the question still remains, how? How is that identity established?
Mr. Chairman, harassment doesn't take place in a vacuum, unless you're dealing with public figures who get unknown people harassment. Usually the harasser is somebody within a small context, work-related friends. So there are circumstantial evidence from what one says, from what one does. The activity itself can lead to the type of action. And the beauty of this type of legislation, and the expert will correct me that I'm wrong, if I'm wrong, that it lends itself to a type of order. If you are doing stop, now it's the stop beating your wife. Whether you're beating or not, I'm ordering you to stop you. And that's possible, the harassment notice, if you are sending all these SMSs, stop. And confronted with the court order, most people will stop and they will not go to the next step of facing contempt of court.
I just need to bring something to the attention of the committee. It's in the cyber world as such, it's almost impossible to investigate the origin of a call. Only people that can actually assist you, saying to ADR, the service providers that provide that service. And I believe I stated it previously that these people will never release any of your information unless they're compelled by a court order. Obviously, they will face civil litigation if they do release some of this information. And, to address this position, we feel that it's absolutely necessary to assist through legislation to provide recourse to a victim and to aid to help in the investigation of a case, that this information be made available. And that is the reason why it has been inserted in this bill. I cannot think of any other manner how you can investigate electronic communications. In the area, you can receive 50 nameless SMSs. You will never find out who the perpetrator is unless you approach the service providers who can provide you with the address and identity of that person.
I think we've realized it, but let me just say it again. We are dealing with stalking out of a domestic, outside the domestic sphere, and I think that is more open to where you might not know your harasser as opposed in a domestic situation. I think it's invariably you're going to know who the person is.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm just worried by the over sympathy with the perpetrator, because this situation is the situation that caused a lot of women in South Africa not to complain about harassment, because there is a feeling that the perpetrator maybe receive a lot of sympathy and consideration in the police stations, in the courts.
So I would like us to actually pay a lot of sympathy with the complainant more than the perpetrator.
Chairperson, I'll proceed to the next point. The question was also raised regarding the ability of electronic communication service to providers to comply with the proposed Clause 3A. As has been indicated by Mr. Bassett, we did circulate a bill for responses to the service providers. We received some responses, and in general, I believe is that all service providers indicate that they can comply with the provisions of this legislation. I will go through the comments later. I must mention that although we haven't received official comment from Cell C and Vodacom, a meeting has to take place during which the provisions of the bill were raised with them, and they has indicated that they can comply with the provisions of the bill. So that is the general background. So due to the fact that it's very similar to the RICA process, I believe no service provider will have a problem to provide the required information to a court of law. Mr. Chairperson, must I go through the comments specifically of each service provider? Not necessary. In any event, the comment is attached as Annexure B. Okay. The next question that was raised relates to Skype and Wi-Fi as a medium of harassment. I did discuss the position of Skype in the document here, and as such, Dr. Ambrosini is correct. There will be anonymity. You cannot trace a person on Skype. The same might be where harasser utilized Wi-Fi as well as internet cafes. However, if internet cafes is used, you can probably trace the communications back to the internet cafe itself, but you will not be able to trace the harasser. Similar to Wi-Fi, I discussed the matter with the people from ISPON. They indicated that if an internet IP address is available, it may be possible to trace the communication back to the person if that person has been RICA'd in South Africa. That is more or less a general overview of the concerns or the examples that Dr. Ambrosini raised. It must further be pointed out that in the People's Republic of China, Skype is actually, well, you can intercept communications in terms of them. Skype, to enable Skype, you have to download certain software, and dependent on how you configure this kind of software, it might make Skype interceptable. It's also indicated in the document that the same concerns has been raised by the law enforcement agencies that these medium of communications poses a big risk for law enforcement agencies, and it will be addressed through further amendments to RICA at a later stage. We can then, if necessary, amend the bill to accommodate this as well. Okay, the next point that is up for discussion is the objection against revealing the identity of a person who communicates electronically with a complainant. This relates to a concern that Dr. Ambrosini has raised and again raised in this committee. To accommodate Dr. Ambrosini, I wish to refer the committee to a new option that has been inserted in the bill. It's on page 50. of the document named Work Document 1 March 2011, where we the new option under Subtools 5, where we compile electronic communication service provider to inform a person whose particulars is provided to the court at least 24 hours before this is provided to the court of the happening. And we submitted that this might give him enough time in the area to ask for order to stop the service providers from providing this information. But certain aspects need to be taken into account here. On the one hand, it has been indicated in the document that if you inform a person beforehand that there is a protection order pending against him and that you're going to release his information to a court of law, the possibility exists that this person may approach a court and indefinitely protect his rights to an extent, and further on, the person may also increase his harassing behavior. So it's something that needs to be considered when the committee considered this option. I also referred to the position on the Protection of Personal Information Act, and I think we have discussed that adequately. Yes, going for that. In all the comment that we received from the service providers, I believe every service provider is opposed to the clause. If the telecoms complained against the proposed clause is the idea that it will place a great administrative burden on telecom to inform the person of the fact that they're going to release this information. MTN has indicated that the person will inter alia be informed via cell phone by means of an SMS, and that there's a possibility that the information that needs to be provided to the person might exceed the 160 characters of an SMS. The internet service providers are also opposed against this. They probably misunderstood it due to the fact that they said a person will be informed of this fact when the protection order is served on them. So there's a general objection against this by the service providers. I believe CELC, who hasn't responded in writing yet, indicated that they also object to this, as well as Vodacom. Neotel has not yet responded to this clause.
Are they anticipating that many of these applications? It's quite scary.
I have a concern. We are dealing with internet service providers, and we are dealing with cell communication providers. Now, those are not necessarily the channel through which communication takes place. Unless we create a legislative framework which enables them to seize the programs. Let me put it this way. I can, if I have the skills, develop a communication program packaging which could operate amongst all of us, like SCAPI. SCAPI is nothing else than a piece of software in your computer and a piece of software in somebody else's computer, and they constantly use the internet to find one another, and as soon as one comes in, they link to one another. We could create the same network with 3 people, with 300 people, with 3,000 people. The creation of Facebook doesn't require anything. You get a program, you give the same program to other people. The communication does not take place on the internet. It takes place on Facebook, on Skype, on Twitter. The internet service provider has no access. It's just the guy who provides the highway. the cell communication provider has no access to what is being said and what has been exchanged. So I'm not, and the person who, and the entity which provides the means of exchange, the program developer, is unreachable. So it's, I don't see how one can get around these difficulties, either by imposing obligations which cannot be fulfilled, or obligations which cannot be, which don't belong there. At a certain point, the internet is a space of freedom. If you go to a costume party, everyone is wearing a mask. Now you will operate in that type of environment. Everyone wears a mask. In the on the internet space, rules are different. And I'm not sure whether we are trying to put a round peg into a square hole or vice versa.
I seem to recall that it was you that raised whether we shouldn't provide an opportunity for the alleged perpetrator to be informed. It was you that raised that concern. Shouldn't the alleged perpetrator be informed of the pending order to be made against him or her? And that is all that Mr. Robertson and Mr. Bassett have tried to do here. Now, if you're saying we shouldn't proceed along those lines, then is it because you've changed your approach, or...?
I agree on that. I was looking at the next sentence, where there are electronic communication service provider must provide and maintain a list of electronic communication services providers. I mean, it's... unless I'm misreading it, that means that MNET or Telcom must provide a list of all the software applications which anyone can run, which are capable of providing communications.
Dr. Bastia, I believe we don't. Oblige electronic communication service providers in terms of this bill to do anything else that is already done in terms of other legislation. The software is already out there in terms of which you can trace the person that used the telecommunication service network. So we're doing nothing, or don't put any further obligations on that providers in terms of this bill to do anything else. This is just for them to use currently available protocols in terms of which persons can be traced.
Just trying to think logically here, we're saying that the service providers must inform the alleged perpetrator, and that's by way of a court order. Will it be the court that instructs the service provider? It will be the court.
This is a new standing provision which will oblige a service provider, before he gives the information in terms of a court order to the court, to also inform the respondent of the fact that he's going to hand the information over to the court. This is not in terms of the direction of the court. It's obligation imposed by legislation on the electronic communication service provider.
Taking that a bit further, I mean, surely there should be some kind of indication then as to which court is going to in a case number. So if the guy does want to challenge it, you know, go to court at the hearing, then they will be able to do that.
I believe if you look at clause 5, we did make provision for that. Firstly, in terms of clause 305, the information that electronic communication service provider must provide to a respondent is more or less a description of the information that was or is provided to a court, the reference number of the direction, and the name and address of the court. I think that will give a sure indication at which court it will be heard and precisely what they will give to a court. Moving on, again, Dr. Amrassini asked a question regarding corroboration to substantiate cyber harassment. It's our submission that in terms of clause 4, there are various safeguards built into the bill, into ADR, to ensure that harassment actually took place. Due to the fact that the protection order is considered by a court must usually find on the balance of probabilities, in light of all the circumstances, that harassment actually has taken place before the court will entertain application for a direction in terms of clause 3A. I wish to also refer to clause 3.2, where there are certain factors that need to be considered by a court before we will actually consider interception direction or a direction, not interception direction, in terms of clause 3A. Namely that there was real harassment, there was harm, and that a protection order is necessary to stop the harm. And from a court perspective, I believe if you deal with expert applications, there are certain rules that is well established through the stare decisis rule, how it must be dealt with. And I believe a court will not lightly deviate from these rules when considering an ex parte application from an order for a protection order against harassment. Okay, the next clause, or the next issue that was raised, it relates to a question that was posed by the Honourable Mr. Swart. The question was, if property, in terms of clause 7A, is being collected by the complainant in the presence of a police official, and there's dispute over the property, what is the position? And our submission is that the court per se will only grant an order for a person to confiscate property if it has been proved that the person is the owner of the property. Otherwise the court cannot make any order to that effect. I believe we also refer to the domestic violence regulations, in terms of which a person, if he applies for a protection order, give reasons why certain property is his, and we indicated that that is probably the way we are going to move. And this statement that's made in the domestic violence form is usually made under oath. So this is the way we can move if we make regulations in terms of the bill. However, the question was inter alia ask what can the person do if a person deprives him of his property unlawfully. And it's obviously that if a person makes a statement under oath and it later transpires that this is incorrect, he can be charged with the offence of perjury or offence of contravening section 3193 of the Old Criminal Procedure Act of 1955. The procedure in the Magistrates Court relating to the attachment of property, there is a certain relief provided in terms of that the Magistrates Courts Act, but which will not be applicable to the bill. That is that you came through an interpleader action, which is provided for in the Magistrates Courts Act by way of section 69 read into A with rule 44, bring a formal application before a Magistrates Courts Magistrates Court to determine who the ownership of property. The alternative remedy will inter alia be a spoliation order. It's a kind of interdict relating to where possession of property is restored to the original owner pending final determination. And furthermore, if a person is unlawfully deprived of his property, he can always lay a charge of theft against the other party. Now, this is all the remedies that's available if property is unlawfully removed from the ownership of a person. In light of all the remedies that already exist, it's our submission that we do not need to provide for additional procedure to determine ownership of property. In the document, Rule 44 is attached inter alia as Annexure E. That sets out the procedure, and Annexure D is the form to the Domestic Violence Act, and the item 9 makes provision for the description of personal property and on what grounds the property should be considered as personal property. This will be part of the domestic violence interdict application form.
We appreciate the remedies that exist, but what is the remedy in the Domestic Violence Act on the issue of the property? Surely we can build in a similar remedy here that prevents, and I'd like your guidance as to why you don't think it would work. I understand the other issues, but take for example the issue of an innocent third party, a lease, you know, where there's a lease or something, and that party's got a right to some form of an interpleader process. I'd just like to get my understanding. If we've got that form of a process in the Domestic Violence Act, then why shouldn't it work in terms of this act?
Mr. Swart, sorry, I don't think there is a formal process in the Domestic Violence Act that makes provision for a party to contest the property, the ownership of the property. I believe even during consideration of the Domestic Violence Act, I think the general argument was that there is other remedies available, which is already there in civil law. It's more formalistic and it will usually cost the party money. That is the downside to it. Our submission is that if we make provision for such a procedure in this bill, it might be very time consuming. Parties will always come back to contest the ownership of property, and it might really stretch out the proceedings in terms of this bill. Due to the fact that other bills already, other acts, provide remedies, it's our submission that it should rather be dealt with in terms of the other acts.
Chair, I don't know whether you've had a look at the proposal on page 24 of the bill. It says the court may order a peace officer to... number two, accompany the complainant or related person to a specific place to assist with arrangements regarding the collection of personal property identified in the application for a protection order. And then in the regulations, if you have a look what's in the domestic violence regulations, as Mr. Roberts says, item 9, there's a table, and this I think this was circulated. There you've got to give the complainant must give a property description, the grounds on which the property is considered to be personal property, and the address where the property is kept. So I think it's all that is done under oath. So that's the route that we are suggesting, and we put into the provision that property must be identified in the application order. So the court has, when making that order, will restrict the property to the property that's been identified in the application order.
Moving over to the next point, Mr. Jeffrey is not here, but he raised a concern. It relates to the serious news of cyber harassment versus real-time harassment, and how I owners have proved. Well, I've Googled the most of the incidents that was provided, or examples that's provided below, relates to internet searches as well as recent newspaper reports on some issues, and so read it out or go through it. I think it's necessary. You can look at it. Relating to the high onus of proof, well, it is submitted that no distinction should be made between cyber harassment and real-time harassment. On the one hand, in light of the examples above, we submit it's the seriousness of cyber harassment is more or less the same as that of real-time harassment, and so therefore it should be treated equally. It must always also further be pointed out that cyber harassment in most instances will provide corroborative evidence that cyber harassment has taken place, which will not always be available in real-time harassment. Take, for instance, a single witness which inter alia complained that she is being stalked by Peeping Tom. There will not be any other corroborative evidence, and the court will have to decide the matter on the evidence of a single witness. On the other hand, in the cyber world, there will always be corroborative evidence. The real communication or the cyber communication can be printed out, can be demonstrated to the court through the electronic device, and there's also certain other correlated information that will always corroborate that. So it's our submission that there should not be a higher onus of proof in proving cyber harassment in this matter. The next point raised relates to the definition of harm. I think it was Ms. Hawkstone and Mr. Lamisa. They identified a certain problem with the definition of harm. We did amend the definition of harm. This is on page 4 of the working document, where we now define harm as to mean any mental, psychological, physical, or economical detriment. We did get rid of with harm itself, and the other option will be to leave it out. I must refer you to the dictionary definition of harm if it's left out. I look at two dictionary definitions of harm. One or both define harm as physical or psychological injury or damage or a wrong of evil, and that's about what it means in ordinary everyday language. If you take it out, it will be that meaning. But if it's taken out, one must also take into account that it's subject to the interpretation of the court. On the one hand, the court may give a wider interpretation to the said definition, into alia by interpreting it to something that we that is not intended by the bill, or otherwise give it such a narrow interpretation that it is also not what is precisely intended in the bill. So that is always the problem. If you don't give guidance how a certain word should be interpreted.
Sure, I think a valid point was raised by the Honourable Ambrosini earlier. What is the difference between mental and psychological? Would it not be okay just to say psychological or physical?
The reason why it was included originally was definitions in the DSM-4 scale of what would be classified as mental harm and what would be classified as psychological harm, and that is why both were included. But I think it may be wide enough if you wish to only have psychological.
If it's going to be used on that basis, but maybe it needs to be a better definition then, or so that we understand exactly what we're talking about, unless we even include mental as included in the DSM-4 or whatever category, something like that. No. It's just, yeah, I mean, as long as if a court has to interpret that, what is it going to say? That's my concern. I mean, but I would rather favor a wider meaning than a narrower meaning.
To the next point, it relates to the concern that was raised that children might exploit the bill and frequently taking their parents to court. We have inserted a new option in the bill to provide, therefore, that a child cannot, out of own accord, anymore apply for a protection order. It's on page 10 of the working document. It's marked option. And we then say that the effect of the option that was inserted is that any adult person may on behalf of a person under the age of 18 years approach the court for a protection order in terms of this bill without the assistance of a parent, a guardian, or any other person. I believe if that is read in conjunction into either with the court order that the court can give in terms of the bill, it should be adequate to belay this fear that courts will be inundated with applications. But I have referred previously to the Domestic Violence Act where there's a similar provision, and I've also indicated that I don't think courts were inundated with applications. Unless the However, if you consider this provision, we must keep Section 14 of the Children's Act into mind. This section states that every child has the right to bring and to be assisted in bringing a matter to court, provided that the matter falls within the jurisdiction of that court. And in terms of Section 15 of the Children's Act, in Bill of Rights matters, a child will have standing in a court of law. So it actually calls for a policy decision how we must proceed further on this matter. It is our submission, in light of the fact that the courts were not inundated with applications under the Domestic Violence Act, that this may provide some relief to certain children in certain circumstances.
The proposal that you've made now, do you think that that complies with the Children's Act? Is it consistent with the Children's Act? I mean, that the child still has a right, but they must just be assisted by an adult.
To an extent, yes, we agree with it, but my submission is that it will comply with it. Moving on to the next next point for discussion, it relates to the service of protection orders in terms of this bill. It was raised by Ms. Schaefer, and it relates to including in the bill the procedure how to serve documents and not use subordinate legislation. We have drafted an option for consideration. It's on page 12. Just want to modify it a bit. It should read, in a matter prescribed by the rules of the court in question for the service of process, and the words in brackets should be deleted, please. And also the comments in under the paragraph should be deleted. That is how we can make provision for it. Otherwise, we can just replicate Rule 9 of the Magistrates Courts Act in the clause. It will have the same effect. This was taken from other legislation where similar provisions were used. However, it's our submission that procedural issues should preferably be dealt with by means of subordinate legislation. This was also the process that was followed in the Domestic Violence Act. If you look at Regulation 50, where it prescribed the process that should be followed if you want to serve protection orders in terms of the Domestic Violence Act. So basically, we think that this is a procedural issue and we should rather deal with that by way of subordinate legislation. The advantage there too is that if you encounter a problem, obviously subordinate legislation can be changed easily. If Parliament really want to have control over it, provision can be made in the regulation clause that may either be submitted to Parliament or inter alia be approved by Parliament, which will give Parliament the same oversight.
I'm not quite sure I understand what you're saying. So are you saying that the proposal you're making, you're not actually in agreement with? Are you saying we should rather say in the prescribed manner?
Don't agree with it.
The route that was followed in the domestic violence legislation was in the prescribed manner. That's a matter that the committee can give us guidance on what they would prefer to.
Bring on. On to the next point, it's sort of related to a question that was asked by Ms. Schaefer. The question was asked why a protection order should only be valid upon service, and it was indicated that the interdict is valid when it's granted by a court. Okay, and I have stated the general principle that applies to civil law. Interdict operates from the moment that it is granted and the respondent receives information which he or she has no reasonable ground for disbelieving that such an order has been granted. I refer to two authorities, which is also attached as Annexure F. It's the case of Elliot Bross versus Smith in Consolidated Fish Distributors, and the gist of the judgments has been indicated in the text. We have inserted the option to make provision, therefore, that is on page 12, indicated option under subclause 6, which provides the interim protection orders of force and effect from the moment it has been issued by the court, and the existence thereof has been brought to the attention of the respondent. This option will have the effect that the protection order do not need to be served on the respondent, but that he must have knowledge thereof, inter alia be informed of the protection order. Move on to the next point for discussion. A concern was raised that there may be a failure of applications by the South African Police Service for extension of the period to determine the identity of harasser, and I think Ms. Schaefer, if I had proposed that reasons should be inserted in Clause 3B on grounds of which the South African police may apply for extension. We have thought about the whole issue and well, came to the conclusion that this is going to be very difficult. In any event, the court has got the absolute discretion to grant the extension or not. It has been stated in various cases. So I earlier wish to refer to the case of Arda Sazaki in 1945, the appeal court decision, which is still current authority on the matter. But in order to address non-compliance with the order, we have inserted a new clause in terms of clause 15.5, which will make it an offence for the police if they willfully or in a negligent manner disregard an order of court to comply with the direction. It's on page 31. It's inserted under subclause 5 that we hope will address the any concerns that is raised that the police will not instantaneously comply with the order of court.
I just add though, it's not that we are necessarily in favour of including the offences of this nature, but it's at the Portfolio Committee's discretion whether you wish to criminalise the actions of the police or not.
I believe we still think that we are still of the opinion that certain non-compliance with the process should rather be misconduct proceedings against the South African police, except where there is a direct court order. Obviously, then it is an offence to disobey a court order per se.
Provision is made for national instructions, and non-compliance with those national instructions will amount to misconduct and disciplinary proceedings within the police force itself as an internal regulatory matter. It is not an offence in terms of domestic violence.
The problem is, you've seen how effective that's been in the domestic violence context. Absolutely not at all. My concern is not really so much whether we're going to criminalise or not criminalise. My concern is that we're not going to, that we don't get police officers coming to the court time after time after time after time, and the court actually just keeps on giving. We know it happens all the time. The court is only too happy to have an excuse not to hear the matter, so they'll grant another postponement. That's my concern, and I just wondered whether there was a way of saying in the actual section that they can only, I can't recall the exact wording, it says it can't be an unreasonable delay, or you know, that's what I was thinking. As long as something like the court can, or, you know, the court can on reasonable grounds or something like that. Not detailed stuff. I mean, don't totally, we can't curtail the discretion of the court, but it is at least to give them guidelines that we aren't going to think we don't, that they mustn't entertain frivolous extensions. That's all.
If I may, we have also considered perhaps including a specific time frame, for example, as with the service providers, say 96 hours as well, so that they would have to come forward again. So you actually have a time frame within which they do it. They can't just have a person to do it.
So that they've got some idea that we don't want them to have the option of just completely open-ended postponement. So yeah, that might be a better option.
Moving on to the next point for discussion, it relates to the proposed clause 3C that was inserted. There were two issues raised. One were a constitutional issue, and the second one relates to safeguards against abuse of the procedure. I previously did discuss Section 41 of the Criminal Procedure Act, on which this clause is based to a large extent. Also looked through for similar legislation, and I found that the Intoxicating Liquor Act of 1998 has a similar provision. This act is still applicable to some provinces, and this clause also formed part of the previous Liquor Act. But there's also various other laws that exist out there which actually make it an offence if a person furnishes incorrect particulars relating to a name and address to an array of functionaries. However, none of this legislation give that functionary arresting powers to verify the correctness of that the particulars that was provided to him. Our submission is still, as was said previously, is that there was no constitutional challenges yet to Section 41 of the Criminal Procedure Act, and it's our submission that a case can probably be made out that this provision should be considered as constitutional in light of what it aims to achieve. However, we went a bit further and, in order to build in certain safeguards in the provision, refer the committee to clause 15.7, that is on page 32. We created certain offences. If a police official abuses these powers inter alia to obtain other information that is not required in terms of section 3C, and otherwise a police official cannot use this section to inter alia obtain a person's particulars if it's not specifically done for the purposes of clause 3C. If he does that, it is an offence, and we propose that a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 6 months be imposed for a contravention of this clause. This is similarly then to section 28 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which also creates an offence if a person unlawfully search certain premises not so if it's not authorized by the Criminal Procedure Act.
We feel a bit more comfortable by having an offence here, because here the policeman is acting outside his scope of duties, and I think that there really is justification for something along those lines. So it's prior to the court order, is that right? On page 18 at the top where you say, may if it appears.
Section 3C was created in order to give the police certain powers to investigate. Firstly, a discretionary power is given to the police to investigate certain instances of harassment. So this information on oath is information that's provided to the South African police.
Establish to what degree there can be abuse by the police, you know, so you need an affidavit before the police can do anything, is that right? But not there's no court order yet, obviously. That's right.
Yes, Mr. Swart, this is abuse can take place outside the ambit of the section. They've actually, under the pretense of this clause, try to obtain certain particulars of a person, and they haven't got legal authority or backing to do that. That is considered as an abuse. That's the
just on a lighter note, I noticed that we have the Intoxicating Liquor Act, and you have the Liquor Act. thought they were one and the same. I've learned today that you have liquor that's not intoxicating.
But this one's good. That's what?
This when it's good.
That's when it's good. When it's good. When it's good, it's not intoxicating. No.
Okay, but then the back on this field.
The next point for discussion relates to the examination of witnesses through a court if the respondent is not represented by a legal representative. It was raised by Mr. Lunisa, clause 6.3 of the bill. I've discussed everything. Going to give a kind of shorter summary of everything. Mr. Odemisa's question relates to its idea of fair trial procedure. If you use a cross-examine somebody through another person, it's idea of the magistrate. I think his submission related to that indirect cross-examination may make the trial unfair. We discussed it in depth. The idea I want to refer to is the idea of the intermediaries. Provision that's in the Criminal Procedure Act, which make provision for the giving of evidence through intermediaries, also the cross-examination of a certain person through an intermediary. The fair trial principle was considered in the case K versus the Regional Magistrate. It was a 1969 decision, and the court ruled that principle does not render the trial unfair. As indicated, we also provided extract from the South African Law Reform Commission on sexual offences that deals in depth with this. How can I call it? Certain principle in law, and so our submission is still that. Cross-examination through a judicial officer in certain circumstances will not render the trial unfair. Okay, moving on to the next point. Okay, that relates to Mrs. Schaefer. Originally, the bill provided that if a police officer did not comply with certain orders of the court, it was regarded as an offence, and the penalty that could be imposed for that was something to the effect of fine or imprisonment for a period of 5 years. It was then argued by us that we rather think that it should be a misconduct. It must rather be considered as misconduct. We have inserted a new clause 7.2 in the bill. That is on page 23. It starts on page 23 as the option, and there we differentiate between certain orders that the court can give and specific orders that relates directly to the functions of a police officer in the area to seize any armed dangerous weapons and things to that regard. The criminalizing provision, a further amendment was made to clause 15, it's on page 30, relating to sub clause A, where we make clause 7, 1, and 2 subject to the 5-year penalty, but the others is then outside that, the specific duties that that new clause 73 imposes on these officials. This is actually in the hands of the committee. I'll deal with it further. Our submission is deeded as
deal with such matters as misconduct, other than if the committee wishes, they can decide to make it a serious offence as is currently being proposed in the original bill. Okay, move on further. The next point for discussion relates to the penalties that may be imposed on an electronic communication service provider. That's currently in terms of clause 15.4. The maximum penalties that can be imposed on electronic communication service providers is 10,000 rand, and if it's an employer of an electronic communication service provider, a maximum sentence which includes a fine for a period not exceeding 6 months. The committee indicated that in terms of RICAR, they are more serious penalties, and I wish to refer the members to section 51.3 of RICAR, which make provision that for certain contraventions, the electronic communication service provider can be found guilty of an offence and a fine of 5 million rand can be imposed, and if it's a natural person, a fine of 2 million rand or 10 year imprisonment can be imposed. The relevant clauses of RICAR attached is annexure H. So again, it's in the discretion of the committee if they want to increase the penalty or not. The bill was also circulated to the Department of Communications, and they indicated that they actually echo the sentiments of the committee that the fine should be increased. Okay, then we were requested by the committee to flag clauses 16 and 17. That relates to regulations being approved by Parliament, and I don't actually know how to respond to what precisely needs to be debated. It might relate, however, to parliamentary oversight over the regulations. Clause has been inserted to make provision, therefore, that for consideration that regulations must be approved by Parliament as a substitute to the submission clause. Further amendments that we from our side have included in the bill for consideration relates to financial assistance to be provided by the state. It's an amendment to clause 16, it's on page 32. And it provides that the minister may make regulations regarding financial assistance to be provided by the state to a complainant who does not have the necessary resources to serve any documents in terms of the act, as well as a witness who attends any proceedings in terms of this act. This relates specifically to clause 4, which makes provision that court may subpoena witnesses to attend court proceedings. Similar amendments were affected to amendments to section 384 of the Criminal Procedure Act, the Domestic Violence Act, and the annexure. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Ambrosini.
Could Mr. Robertson first direct my attention to where regulations are called for in this act?
Mr. Abrasini, regulations inter alia relate to the inter alia, the manner in which application must be done for a protection order. I can go through each and every one.
The chairman,
yeah.
Will you allow me to, if I can take back to the last question at the Hague on this bill, and then I will stay. I will raise that. First, I want to do it fast before Mr. Schwartz leaves. On the definition of harassment, and this the crack. It's the crack, I think, of the piece of legislation. I'm trying to find it, but it, if I will remember, it talks about detriment. And mental, psychological, physical, or economic detriment, is that correct? Yes. Harm, yes. So, there must be harm in order to be harassment, and the harm means a mental, psychological, physical or economic detriment. I mean, that's the operational thing. When a person says, hey, enough. Now, I'm concerned about the physical detriment. I don't know what it means. The only one that I know what it means is economic detriment. Because physical detriment, if there is any physical contact, I'm going to use some overseas terminology, but it's assault and battery. And as soon as there is a physical contact, so and you're in that type of crime, here there is something which seems to be short of physical contact. And again, if we can look at the difference between mental and psychological detriment.
Marcus will look at the definition, if any case.
Bearing in mind, Dr. Embassy, that ultimately we decide.
All right, sorry, I just want to get clarity. We undertook to have a look at the difference between mental and psychological, but those two, whether they're both necessary, but I just want clarity on the other aspect that Dr. Ambrosini raised about physical. I don't know whether I...
What's physical detriment? If you can give me an example of physical detriment, which is not what I call assault and battery.
Dr. Ambrosini, I believe in most instances it will amount to a crime. In South Africa, it will be assault. But there's also a principle in the South African law, the minimis non curat lex, which means, okay, you know about that. You know, there's certain irritating actions that may be of a physical nature, which a reasonable person will not interpret as amounting to assault. So, you know, if I shoot you with a piece of paper and a piece shoot in your back, and I'm not harming you, it might be irritating, but you know, that might be something that is something under the minimis non curat lex. But it's irritating, it's not prosecuted, so afford the person at least the opportunity to have some remedy available to get rid of the irritation.
Honourable members, where do we go from here?
Chairperson, from the department side, we want to request that before we finalise the bill as such, have a discussion with the Internet Service Providers Association relating to Clause 3A. They indicated that a new procedure may be inserted. It will be a short amendment to the proposed Clause 3A to cater specifically for internet service providers. We will communicate it to the committee as soon as it is drafted.
Yeah. Okay. They're not the most cooperative bunch of people, from my experience. All right, fine. Honourable members, what do you think? We should afford them that opportunity?
I have no problem with that, Mr. Chair. I just suggest that maybe we could also, while you're busy with that, just get info from them. I am seriously concerned that they're so worried about this administrative burden about giving courts information. I cannot believe there are that many cases of arrest. And maybe they can give us some indication as to whether they are aware of how many cases there could be and why they say it's going to be such an administrative burden.
I would not
mind. If they get the notice from the court, it'll all be on there anyway. So, I mean, it'll simply be a matter of sending an SMS saying, this is going to be sent to this court tomorrow at this case number. I mean, how difficult is that?
Well, I would not mind if we had an opportunity of asking them questions ourselves.
Well, all of the service providers has indicated that they're willing to attend any proceedings and assist further with the electronic part of the bill, especially the internet service provider, so they are available.
No, what else we want that we haven't got already, but I mean, if we can quiz them on more detail maybe, but I mean the obligations are there in RICA anyway, so I don't know what else we really want to know.
I'm always in favor of voting for knowledge, so let's find out.
Specifically on that option that we've brought in where the service providers give information to the respondent.
One is just reminding me correctly. Ask them to give us something in writing, okay? And then we'll find a slot for them. Honourable members, okay? Can't do any harm. Mr. Bassett.
Aren't they worried about being involved in litigation then, because they will be, if the, I think, should we request it, Chair? Would it not be better coming from the committee itself? Doing it, but that perhaps. Again, sorry, Mr. Roberts has said on the policy directives and the regulations, the committee must make a decision on whether it must come to Parliament for approval or not. I've just had a look in the Domestic Violence. They don't. The Domestic Violence Act doesn't require the regulations or the policy directives or the regulations in any event to be approved by Parliament. It just says that they must be submitted to Parliament prior to publication thereof, and the directives, I think. Directives as well, I think. So the committee might feel that you want the approval here. And if I may just add on to that, Chair, when we were dealing with the trafficking bill on the regulations, the committee raised a concern about the regulations enabling provision making, providing that any contravention of a regulation can be subject to criminal sanction. In other words, that the regulations can build in criminal sanctions. I don't know whether you recall there was that concern. We've got a similar provision in this bill. So I just want to alert the committee to that fact. But we would like to argue that's, and we've done a bit of research. We can make that available. I can take you through it now, or we can distribute it, whatever you feel. We've got some information from textbooks. And it would seem as if this is not a provision that it isn't problematic, and it's in fact a necessity, and it's done all over the world really, where it's necessary to have to give regulations teeth, to make them effective. Sometimes there are areas where you have to insert a criminal sanction, but we have got reading material on that if you'd like us to make that available.
The Honourable Shobastole, followed by Mrs. Schenker.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, it's a pity the Chair has already made a ruling, you know, without the rural opinion. Because I would have loved them to come here. But anyway, for now it's okay.
Yeah, I think constant comparisons of Domestic Violence Act are doing the department more harm than good. I mean, the Domestic Violence Act, I mean, really, it's very problematic. And, I mean, there was a provision in there for some unknown reason that gives the police unlimited rights to ask for an exemption from complying with the provisions of the Act. Now, what the heck is the point of that? And 10 years down the line, it's still there. Yes, it is. Section 18, she go, look. Anyway, they could apply to the ICD for exemption from being prosecuted for misconduct. In any case, the point is, I think that I think we should have regulations coming back to us for approval. I do think, as I said before, I'm concerned about time limits. We need to make sure that it doesn't hold up the process. But I do think, especially if there are going to be criminal sanctions for non-compliance, then we can't just allow we can't sort of delegate that authority to make something a crime without us having sight of it. So I would say that they should come to us.
In terms of legislation, criminalising provision is already established by Parliament. Question to ADA indicates that a crime may be committed if certain conditions of regulation is not adhered to. That's usually one of the options that can be followed. Parliamentary overseeing of that regulation afterwards will be approval of that regulations and the offences created by way of subordinate legislation. Well, that's the appropriate way to do it. I've seen legislation in the area which say that somebody that doesn't comply with the regulations is guilty for offence and punishable with whatever. That's a problematic clause to be inserted due to the fact that if the regulations require a person to submit something in duplicate and they only submitted a single copy thereof, then he actually commits an offence. So that is probably another way to go. But rather criminalise it through subordinate legislation, let it come back to Parliament for approval.
And saying it looks like we're done for today. All right. Mr. Bassett and the rest of your team, thank you, all of you. you've given us food for thought. We've flagged those issues that you've highlighted for us where we are required to take a decision. And I suppose when we find a slot again, hopefully we'll all be ready to take those decisions and then we'll move forward from there. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
It keeps me busy because I spend a lot of time at mall.
How are you, my friend? So much.
Yes, thanks.
But you never know, because some guys can get it, but some of them can get it much. Go out with a friend, unfortunately, she wasn't Romanian. She went to Pretoria, and then they think that
Romania. I was watching Top Gear when he went to which words that he hinted at. It is terrible.
In terms of what?
I recorded it.